I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. Lori Marker. She's founder and executive director of the Cheetah Conservation Fund. She's a conservation scientist, and she's speaking to us from their center in Namibia. And photographer Susie Esterhaas, their new book is called A Future for Cheetahs. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So the first thing you notice about cheetahs when you look at this book is how absolutely beautiful they are. And I just have to say it, how utterly cute the little cheetah cubs are. What attracted each of you to work with cheetahs?
Well, I could go first. This is Lori, and I have been working with cheetahs for over 40 years. So that's kind of a long love affair I've had with cheetahs. I started working with them at a wildlife park in Oregon, and back in those days, nobody really knew anything about cheetahs, and they fascinated me, looking at their eyes and their beauty. And, you know, I asked people around the world, you know, what do you know about cheetahs? And people just kept saying, when you find out something about cheetahs, let us know. And as the fastest land animal, we need to know more about them, and that just sort of drove the next 40 years of my life. And I do agree there's nothing more beautiful than the cheetah, and the cubs are just amazing. But if you look into their eyes just take you into, you know, into the future and into the past.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a very great depth of them, and they look through you almost. And you always try to, you know, look at them, and they sort of look around you. They're looking into the distance. And I think, I guess from what all I've learned about them, I have looked through them into different worlds. And their worlds are so different than ours as humans, and yet their very survival today is in our hands. And that is, you know, I guess one of the big things, if you start unraveling all the issues with cheetahs, you start understanding, you know, why, you know, what you're seeing, I guess, is they're trying to look into our future.
Susie, you photograph all kinds of endangered species. How did you get involved with the Cheetah Project?
You know, I just fell in love with cheetahs really early on. I mean, I guess as a kid, I loved them. But then when I was younger, I had the opportunity to work in the Serengeti for a bit and work with different predators. And I immediately fell in love with cheetahs because they're so unique as far as a predator goes. And when I first went, I sort of lumped them into the category of lion and leopard, and I realized, you know, cheetahs are absolutely completely unique and very special, you know, being built for speed. They're very elegant and also very delicate, and they have a very different nature than the other predators in the fact that they can be quite docile, and they're very vulnerable to predation from the other predators and also by humans. And I just saw them as this very beautiful, very vulnerable animal, yet, you know, sort of this really enigmatic creature out there that was sort of surviving against the odds. So I kind of got it into my head that I wanted to do a project on a mother raising her cubs to adulthood, you know, again, sort of against all the odds. And I found Lori. It was very easy to find Lori as the world's leading expert on cheetahs, and we sort of partnered up on this project and decided that we would go forward with a book together.
It's interesting to think of cheetahs as so vulnerable because they're so fast and agile. They can run 70 miles an hour, as you write in the book. They can turn on a dime 180 degrees, even going full speed. That makes them very adaptive as hunters, but in what ways are they also vulnerable?
In the wild, they are very fast, but everything in their body, their whole physiology has been built for speed. And with that, they've given up other things. And the other large cats all have very powerful bones and heavy bones to hunt with differently, and sharp claws and big teeth and big jaws, where the cheetah, being the fastest land animal, doesn't have any of those. And with that, although it has speed, it's an animal that is called flight or fight. And so they won't fight, and therefore they run away. And with that, they lose a lot of their prey in the wild to other large predators, lions, hyenas, even jackals will scare the cheetah away, or vultures from their food. And they're also very vulnerable because they can't necessarily protect their cubs. And then their cubs become quite vulnerable as well to predation, to the other large carnivores. So those are the big issues with them, fast and yet not aggressive.
And if you look at a cheetah next to a lion, it's like looking at a ballerina next to a football player. I mean, I've seen them together. I've seen lions beating up on cheetahs. They're very different structurally and behaviorally as well. It's, you can just absolutely see their vulnerability when you see them being faced by other predators.
Very interesting. And their cubs are very vulnerable when they're small, too. And most of them don't actually make it.
Well, in the Serengeti or in the larger game reserves, and I should point out that throughout all of Africa, although there are a lot of game reserves, there are really only around 10 reserves large enough to maintain a viable population of cheetahs because of the conflict with these other large predators, lions and hyenas. They're protected, their numbers grow, and then the cheetah gets pushed out. And when they're in these reserve settings and there is that high competition, it's been shown to be about 90% infant mortality under the first 3 months. That's when the cubs are most vulnerable. That's when mother's leaving them to hunt on her own. The cubs are left, and if they do run into lions or hyenas, they often are killed. So that's where that vulnerability is. Out in areas where I'm based in Namibia, we see about a 50% mortality under about a year and a half, at which point they will then leave their mother. And many of those that are human-caused, from farmers seeing the cheetah, trapping them, catching them, or something where a cub might break a leg. So there are some natural problems for them as well. But most of the problems that we see are large carnivores that are killing the cubs in these game reserves.
And I should say, you know, in my experience working with these different cubs, the photos you see in the book of the newborn cubs, I watched all five of them die over 19 days. And that's one of the things that was heartbreaking about the project was I originally envisioned I would follow the same cheetah family. And what I realized is that's just not possible, A, with how much cheetahs move. They were just moving into huge, large areas where I couldn't follow them between two countries. But also, too, you know, these cubs were just flat out dying in front of me. And so what you see in the book is actually a few different cheetah families of cubs of different ages. But yeah, watching those five die, you know, when Lori first told me about the statistics out of the Serengeti, I thought, gosh, that's really high. But then watching those five die, you know, really drove it home that this is absolutely true. And that was just natural predation. And then, you know, if you throw on top what we as people are putting on them, in addition to the threats they naturally face, it really is pretty miraculous.
It's ironic that they do worse in wildlife reserves.
Well, but that's kind of the natural balance. And so maintaining a viable population is all about numbers. You have to have large enough areas and enough of them, and then there is a numbers game. And we, you know, manage those numbers by understanding them, by studying them. And so then those are natural things. And we realize that as biologists, we realize that there is going to be losses and can understand that. And what we've done is to be able to explain that to people who, you know, love them and don't study them. And from that, we do know that there are successes. Many of these mothers that Susie got to also watch are called like supermoms, where they were able to raise their cubs to adulthood. And those females and those young men are the ones that will be probably more viable in the future because they've learned a lot from their mom. Learning how to live in the wild is a very hard job, and the mother is the one who teaches them on her own. And she's raising those cubs on her own for about 16, 18 months, up to 22 months. And with that, she's the one responsible. They're not very good hunters that well, hunting, until they leave the mom. And then they hone their skills a little bit better together as adolescent cubs. And then from there, the female cub will go off and breed and raise her cubs alone. So it is a process, and it is numbers, and it is the wild. What our problem is that our wild is getting smaller and smaller, and many of their habitats are encroached by humans and their livestock, and many of the people that we see and we work with are living in subsistence lifestyles, and so they're quite poor. And with that, any loss of their livestock to a predator, be it a cheetah or a lion or a jackal, they will go out and actually then also try to kill that predator as well. So a lot of the work that we deal with is to try to stop that human-wildlife conflict while working with the people in the communities and trying to then study them, obviously, in the reserve and share that with people to know what we're dealing with.
We're talking to Dr. Lori Marker and photographer Susie Esterhaas about their book, A Future for Cheetahs. Now, where did cheetahs evolve, and where are their main habitats now?
Well, they actually evolved in North America but many millions of years ago. And then much of our fossil remain literature, both genetic literature, has been able to track them over the land bridge into China, throughout Europe, India, down into Africa, which today, that is where they are living, in Africa primarily, with the remnant population of the Asian cheetah in Iran, where there are less than 100. And just to give you the numbers of what we're dealing with cheetahs, we're dealing with a world population of only about 10,000 cheetahs, and that is a 90% decline in the last 100 years. So we've seen the decline rapidly, and now we're trying to not only hold the fort and then grow the populations. Namibia is considered the cheetah capital of the world, and that's where I'm based, and that's where we have set up the Cheetah Conservation Fund. And from our base here, we work with the other cheetah range countries and biologists in those countries to help develop programs to try and grow the cheetah numbers, which is a part of the future for the cheetah. And I should point out that up until around 10 to 12,000 years ago, the cheetah was actually living in North America. And there we did lose it at that point in time. And that was a point in time that's called the Pleistocene extinction, where throughout North America, just for the point that that's where we're talking to you from, there we lost several of the large mammals at that point in time, from the sloth bear to the mammoth and some of the other large saber-toothed cats. And many of these species also went extinct. But the cheetah did not go extinct. However, its numbers were very low, and its numbers have come back. But it left the cheetah genetically compromised. All the cheetahs basically look very similar to each other. And by that loss of genetic diversity, it's also made the cheetah even more vulnerable to the smaller populations, the fragmented populations throughout their range that we're seeing today.
Yeah, the loss of genetic diversity is very interesting. There's not that much you can do about it, or is there?
No, all we can do is stop them from indiscriminately being killed and allow natural selection to take place. And again, that's why we work so closely with the livestock farming communities, rural communities throughout their ranges in Africa, to try to develop programs that will allow the cheetah's numbers to at least stabilize. We would like them to grow over time as well. And with that, we have to find ways that we can, the populations to have some sort of dispersal into the other population to allow their gene pool to not become too small. And so those are the big pictures that we're looking at in actually how to map out the world population of cheetahs and then look at the numbers and how we're going about developing programs to save them. Many of the programs that we are doing at Cheetah Conservation Fund are called Future Farmers for Africa. And I'd love people to go to our website, which is cheetah.org, and there you can learn not only more about our programs, but that's where you can get the book. Our book's also available at Amazon. But we really encourage people to read more about the work that we do. And the stories, again, from our book and the pictures just tell the story beautifully.
One of the things that I think is such a beautiful, elegant, and fairly simple solution is when you have farmers that have livestock, you give them guard dogs, you give them good cattle dogs as puppies, and those successfully keep the cheetahs away, and therefore there's not this hostility between farmers and cheetahs.
Well, right, and the dog that we use is actually an ancient breed of dog. It's from Turkey, really. Although there are about 20 breeds of livestock guarding dogs, it's been used for 1,000 years on the Anatolian Plateau. And it's called the Anatolian Shepherd or the Kangal dog, and it actually lives right with the goats and sheep, and it protects the livestock from predators. They're a large breed of dog. We picked this dog because it has a short hair, independent thinking, covers large areas. And what they do is they bark loudly, and they basically say to the predator, I'm here, I'm really big, leave my flock alone. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that predators are not wanton livestock killers. They don't want to just go out and catch livestock. What they want to do is find a quick, easy meal. And with that, if the livestock guarding dog is there, the barks and the predator knows that it can be in danger. And if anything happens to a predator's body, it can't hunt. And so just having the dog barking loudly, being big, standing its ground, the predators actually, through avoidance, will stay away from these areas. So that's been the really key thing with these dogs. And we breed them, and we then give them to the livestock farming communities, rural farmers, and then teach them about how to raise the dog with their livestock. And we've seen between 80 to 100% livestock, no livestock loss when the farmers have the dog. So it's been a very huge success. And we've bred and placed over 500 of these dogs. And in our book, I mean, Susie's got beautiful pictures of the dogs working out in the bush. You get an idea of what the dogs look like. But our programs have actually been model programs working for predators everywhere. So, you know, we're now working with getting dogs up into Tanzania and Kenya. There's dogs in South Africa that we've helped develop these programs in Botswana. And now the other predator people, jaguar people and mountain lion people, are all looking at our program and realizing that they, too, actually could start affecting change in the livestock communities through better protection of their livestock in a simple way by just using these dogs.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and they're beautiful dogs, I have to say, looking at the pictures of them in this book. Now, when cheetahs, for example, don't prey on livestock because they're guarded by dogs, is there enough prey for them to eat?
Well, throughout much of Africa, that's a big problem. And therefore, programs, again, like Namibia has developed, and we've been a model down here in Namibia, is spending conservancies. And conservancies are where there's an integrated system of livestock that's protected and wildlife on the same land. Prior to this, I think most people think the wildlife is supposed to be the game reserve and the people have their livestock are living outside of that, and yet that doesn't really allow for a really healthy ecosystem. And so as we start looking at integrated systems with, you know, wildlife on the land and enough grazing land and then your livestock protected, then predators can actually live within the system. And predators are a very important part of the system, because they actually increase biodiversity, and that's really what's keeping the land healthier for the human communities. But it's a very big picture, and it's going to take us a longer amount of time to actually implement these things. However, we don't have that much time. And so the areas that we work in, really these conservancies are really important. And a lot of the areas where Susie was doing her pictures, for instance, up in Kenya, was in one of the conservancies up there. And there they have great benefit of having wildlife on the land through ecotourism as well.
I think it's important to just reiterate over and over the fact that predators are so good for ecosystems. Whether we're talking about sharks or wolves or lions or cheetahs, that when you take those predators away, it's really bad for the land and the water in the case of marine animals.
Well, absolutely. The predators actually feed the rest of the whole system, which then allows for biodiversity. And I always talk to our farmers here, livestock farm, you know, if the cheetah's on the land and it makes a kill of a wildlife prey, and then the jackals come and are eating off of the prey that the cheetah's killed, which is wildlife, then they're not going to go out into your goat yard and hunt your goat through the sheep. And people don't always understand those concepts, and they're I call them kind of the basic principles of ecology, that we don't necessarily teach that within our school systems and within our people, and yet we kind of as consumers allow that to even keep going on and on. And that's why I think also consumers and the public plays a key role. And they often go, well, you're over in Africa. You know, what does the cheetah actually, you know, matter to me, you know, in America or in Europe? And yet we actually are kind of the drivers of what is going on globally and can use our consumer power and our knowledge to actually help these very fragile ecosystems where very invulnerable species like the cheetah is living.
And as you point out, the cheetah is part of a much bigger wildlife situation in Africa, including all the poaching, which has now become a kind of mafia, terrorist, big business set of cartels, really. And the challenges are absolutely huge for poaching alone. Do cheetahs get poached?
Well, the biggest problem for cheetahs really is the wildlife trafficking of live trade. The cubs, as you mentioned early on, are very cute, and there is a market for those cubs into live trade. So they are actually being sold as live, you know, cheetah cubs. However, most of them don't make it into the pet market. They are taken from their moms when they're young. They get diseases, feline distemper. They're not given the right food, so they die of malnutrition and improper diet. For every, like, six animals that are caught, you know, maybe one might make it into the illegal pet market. And then even with that, the people who get them don't know how to take care of them. And then those animals die, usually under 2 years of age, which means then the people who want them will go back out and this illegal trade continues. So it's been a huge problem for the cheetah, but the illegal trade and poaching for all of our wildlife is very significant. And, you know, Susie's been able to take pictures of some of this, and our book actually talks about that in the future for cheetahs. And it's actually, you know, shocking the things that she was actually able to photograph as well.
Well, and the other thing, too, with cheetahs and poaching, and I think it's a lot of predators and poaching, especially in places like the Mara in Kenya where I worked, is the, you know, the prey is being poached on a massive, huge scale. There's a commercial meat trade that is very significant in those countries. And, you know, the anti-poaching team that I was able to go out with, you know, we'd go out in one evening and find 52 poachers that were, you know, butchering Thompson's gazelle. This is the prey that cheetahs eat. So for a lot of these animals, it's the fact that their food source is disappearing. And then also, too, you know, there's a lot of snaring going on. And a lot of these predators walk right into the snares. And the snares, of course, will just, anything that walks into them perishes, including elephants and rhinos. So it's quite a big net and a big circle that affects absolutely everything out there.
We're talking to Dr. Lori Marker, founder and executive director of the Cheetah Conservation Fund. She's a conservation scientist, and photographer Susie Esterhaus about their new book, A Future for Cheetahs. Susie, how are you able to take the photographs that you take? I mean, I think we've been spoiled by National Geographic and all these wildlife shows, and we see beautiful pictures of close-up little cubs of whatever the creature is. But as I was looking at this book, I thought, my God, it's as if they were a litter of kittens and you just happened to go up to them with a camera. But cheetahs are wild animals in their own habitat. How did you do it?
Well, actually, cheetahs were, you know, I work with newborns all over the world. That's sort of what I specialize in. And with cheetahs, actually, they weren't incredibly challenging in the fact that in the areas where I was working, they were quite used to people being in vehicles. So when you're out in the Serengeti or the Masai Mara, places like that where people have safaris, you work in your vehicle. You don't ever leave your vehicle. In fact, if you leave your vehicle, the animals sort of assume you're going to do something bad to them. The people that they encounter on foot are usually people that they are going to have a conflict with, whether it's poachers or people managing their livestock. And so animals have learned to fear people on foot. But people in vehicles, on the other hand, they in these tourist areas, they know they're not going to be harmed. So cheetahs weren't incredibly difficult to, you know, I've worked with shy animals that I have to break in over a two-week period. I didn't have to do anything like that with cheetahs because they were already used to vehicles. But what I did do is spend so much time with one individual that, you know, she would get really, really used to me beyond the normal sort of you find a cheetah on a tourist track. You know, she just sort of got used to my vehicle being there all day long. And I work in a way that, especially when you're dealing with babies, you have to be very patient. You have to be very gentle. And you need to really sort of slowly have your presence be there. But you also sort of from being around them so much, you sort of become part of the landscape. That is sort of the ultimate goal when I'm working with these projects. I want to become a boulder in the landscape. I want them to be so used to me that they don't notice me anymore and they just sort of play out their lives around me because I don't want the animal always looking at me and looking into the camera. I want to capture their natural behavior, which means they have to be completely comfortable with my presence and trust the fact that I'm not going to harass them or cause them harm. And the only way to do that is by spending a lot of time with one individual animal so that they learn you do not pose a threat. So when I say a lot of time, some of these females, I worked with some of these cheetah moms for 3 months at a time, every single day, sunrise to sunset. And over, you know, the book itself, I spent over a year, probably a year and a half working with cheetahs.
Did you ever take photographs of cheetahs that were in captivity?
The only captive cheetahs I have are actually the ones that Lori has managed to save in Namibia. And these are cheetahs that have been trapped by farmers. And she is, you know, she took them in and she can talk more about that program. But what they're essentially trying to do is re-release them into areas where they're going to be safer. So those are the only ones that I photographed that were sort of in captivity, and those are very wild cheetahs. Lori also has a few cheetahs that were orphaned as young cubs and are not releasable, and Chewbacca is a great example of that, and serve as ambassadors to educate people. And she has a few cheetahs like that that I was lucky enough to photograph.
Lori, Susie was just mentioning cheetahs that are captured by farmers. What happens to those cheetahs? Do they become domesticated at all, or do you release them back into the wild?
Well, over nearly 25 years here in Namibia, we've tried to stop the catching of the cheetahs by the farmers. In the early years, the farmers were catching 800 to 900 cheetahs a year. And in the 1980s, for instance, it was about nearly 10,000 cheetahs that the farmers had caught. So when I moved here permanently in 1990 and set up the Cheetah Conservation Fund, I started working with the farming community to find out why they were catching them. Was it perceived? Was it actual threat to their livelihood or their livestock? And from that, then we started being able to put them back out into the wild with a radio collar on, understanding about how they're living out there, sharing this information back with the farming community. Some of the cheetahs that we've worked on, though, are little orphan babies and could not go into the wild. Chewbacca, for instance, we got him when he was 10 days old, and he was, you know, very, very sick and raised on a bottle. And as he got well and started growing up, you know, he was bonded to me. So there was no way that he could have ever gone back out into the wild. And ambassador. So yeah, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, through the media, through, you know, photography. He's highlighted in our book as well as a very special ambassador. He lived for about 16 years. We've had a few other cheetahs that are ambassadors like that, but But most of the cheetahs that we work on are able to go right back out into the wild because of the years that we've spent working with the farmers on letting them know about how the cheetah lives, helping with them with their livestock management and wildlife management. And now Namibia has become the cheetah capital of the world. With that, I have to say we still have 40 orphan cheetahs. And some of the cheetahs that come in at 6 months, 8 months of age, they can still not live in the wild without their mom because she raises them and cares for them until they're about 16 to 18 months. Some of these animals, we are able to then start what's called a rewilding or a rehabilitation program. And we've had great success in actually taking these cats that are wild as they can be, however, they're not old enough, raise them up with proper diet and in very large areas and lots of exercise, and then put them into a rehab area and allow them to start learning how to trial and error of how to hunt. In the meantime, we're actually there with them, feeding them until they've got enough sense and know-how to start making their own kills. These wild cats, that once they start learning how to hunt, they then want to stay as far away from us as they possibly can. So our rewilding or our rehabilitation program has been a very huge path, which again gives us hope for a future for cheetahs. Some of the other ranges in Africa and even India where the cheetah went extinct in the 1950s and they want cheetahs back. So we very well may be able to take habitat back for cheetahs. They're an animal that's very important for our grasslands, which are extremely vulnerable throughout arid environments in Africa and Asia. And the cheetah was the top predator of these. And we now have developed techniques that we could very well be able to reestablish populations in other countries.
Very interesting. It's interesting to hear that India wants cheetahs back. You write in the book about how everybody who goes on a wildlife safari in Africa wants to see a cheetah. There's certain wildlife that they always want to see. And it seems like there's real advantages and disadvantages to that kind of tourism. It stresses the animals sometimes, and yet it preserves their habitats. What is the big picture with tourism?
Well, I think with tourism, you have to be educated and understand how the animals live. I think a lot of people think that they're kind of going, you know, some people, on a kind of discovery channel into the bush, and they're going to see everything there is, and you can be, you know, loud and noisy. And what that does is actually stresses out some of the wild animals. And so there is an etiquette on being on safari that good travel operators or tour operators are teaching the tour guides. Are teaching, and what we're looking at in some of these areas is actually certifying those tour guides so that they're providing a appropriate opportunity for the visitors and tourists to see the wildlife. So there is an etiquette that we are trying to teach and share with people, and that has to be then shared back and certified back to, I think, the tour guide.
How do Namibians view the cheetah? I mean, we've talked about farmers protecting their livestock, but is there also a kind of pride in these animals?
Well, I've been working here now in Namibia for nearly 25 years, and the pride has grown and grown. The people have learned about how the cheetah lives. They've learned that the world is aware of Namibia as the cheetah capital of the world. People come to Namibia to see cheetahs, and there is a huge pride. You know, if people see me, you know, when I go into town and I live way out in the bush, you know, it's like, oh, there's the cheetah lady. Isn't that exciting? And, you know, let me tell you what I might have seen if I saw a cheetah. Or I'm just going to let you know that, you know, because of the livestock guarding dogs, we don't have livestock losses. And you've taught us a lot about biodiversity. And that's a huge success to know that. And to have the country all consider itself the cheetah capital of the world, you know, just puts one country on the map, and from there, it's working from that success with all the other countries throughout Africa as well.
You wrote about the importance of the education of women and girls for wildlife conservation. What does that look like?
Well, it's a pretty scary statistic to look at what the population is like. Today, our world our African population under the sub-Saharan Africa is over 2 billion, and 50% of that population is under 25 years of age. In so many of the countries, education is not available, and without education, we see women having 7 to 8 children, and most of them are living in subsistence and poverty life cycles in an arid environment. That means they're drought-prone in an area that we know that climate change is changing these arid environments to even be more drier and drier. And with that, women play a very key role because women are the mothers, and they're the ones that quite often are, you know, taking care of the children and the family and the food and the crops and the livestock. And with that, as we can educate more and more women, they will become the leaders. And we've seen statistically that more women who are educated do have less children, and they often take up much greater roles in government and in community-based programs. So women are extremely important, and I think that's one of the reasons why Susie and I, as two women who have been walking in a men's field for so long, have been supporting women's groups, you know, throughout the areas that we work with in Africa.
Susie, tell us about some of your adventures in Africa as a photographer.
Well, you know, living out in the bush is not for everybody. And I lived in a bush camp for nearly 3 years with absolutely no electricity for the first year and a half. I used to charge things off my Jeep battery, and then I got solar. And, you know, it's literally just living in a tent, a safari sort of military style tent, which is quite small. You can stand up in them, but they're quite small. They're not your sort of one person Yosemite kind of tent, but they're still a tent and they're pretty small. No toilet. And, you know, I had a bush shower in the trees, and we'd heat my water over the fire every night. I had a camp guy that sort of tended camp and was there mostly for security, because living on your own out there as a woman can pose some security issues. And I would just fool around in my Jeep all day and you know, follow cheetahs. And after I worked on cheetahs, I spent time with lions and hyenas and that kind of thing. But it was an incredible way to live. It's filled with a lot of adventure. You know, I had no fences around camp, so there were lots of animals in camp every night. You know, sometimes I had mating leopard by the fire one night. Hyenas would come and sort of sniff around the tent. One night I had a leopard laying on the outside of my sort of veranda area that I had. I knew lots of snake stories, spitting cobras. We had mambas around the shower head one night. I mean, there were definitely, you know, exciting things. I raised a little serval kitten while I was there, which was really fantastic. It's a little shy kitten. Almost looks like a little miniature cheetah that hang out in the long grass, and, you know, had that experience of raising him. And so it was a really extraordinary experience. Lots of solitude. But in incredible moments with animals, particularly with cheetahs, I think, because I spent so much time with them. Out of any animal I've worked with, they're the animal I've spent the most time with. Like I said before, I think it was about a year and a half, if you added it all up, for days that I spent with cheetahs. And they were long days, you know, days where I would, you know, I'd go out at sunrise and I'd find my cheetahs. Sometimes it took me 5 minutes. Other times it would take me 5 hours to find them. Sometimes I didn't find them at all. Because often I was the only one looking for these animals, and I didn't really have help. I didn't have a driver or guide. I drove myself because I preferred to work that way on my own. And, so you sort of spend these long hours with one individual animal, and you get to know their personalities. You know, and the cubs grew up around me, so the cubs would, my vehicle was literally just part of the landscape to them. So they would do things like, you know, play under my car, and, you know, always had to do a head count when I started the vehicle. They had no idea that the car wasn't part of their landscape. And so they were very, very used to me from day one. And that's the beauty of working with some of these newborn animals, is that if you're really patient and very slow about it, they are used to you. And you get attached to these animals. You know, Lori talked about the super moms that I worked with. You know, some of these cheetah moms were doing things that cheetah moms shouldn't do or don't typically do. Like I watched a cheetah mom jump on the back of a hyena to protect her cubs when most mothers would just sort of run. And she didn't. She faced them off and heroically jumped on its back and saved her cubs' lives. So, you know, it definitely, you grew attached to these animals, and when the cubs didn't make it, it was downright devastating. But when you watched, you know, one of the super moms I worked with, she had three cubs that she raised to adulthood, and you watched how many, you know, how many kills she had to make to feed those three, and how she taught them how to kill, and the time and the care and the energy she put into it. It was pretty powerful experience.
When you were in your camp and leopards and other predators who most people would probably be afraid of were there close to you, I mean, you spend your life photographing these creatures for their benefit, whether they know it or not. Do you think they sensed that you were kind of a friendly character?
I don't know about that, but I know that the animals that I spend a lot of time with, I approach them in a way I'm very slow. I mean, there are, for example, I had a jackal family where they were shy, and it took me 17 days to get my first photo. So that means 17 days of just moving my car a little bit closer to the den site every day, just very, very carefully, and then sitting in a hot, stuffy car all day long without taking a single photo so they'd get used to it for 17 whole days. And I know that by the end of that, those jackals knew that I did not mean any harm to them and that they could trust that if my vehicle was there, they didn't have to worry about, you know, me harassing them or doing something to their pups. So I definitely think, you know, and they do, animals do see, they recognize individuals and they certainly recognize different cars, but they also recognize individual people. And I think you can develop a sort of trust with an animal. Would I go as far as saying, is it a relationship? I don't know. I mean, there's certainly times when I felt really connected with these animals. But I think it, you know, is probably just these animals living out their lives around me and not noticing me. That's the beauty of what I do. If you do it right, you can just sort of disappear and they don't even notice you're there. And that's when you can document the good stuff, the juicy stuff, as we like to say.
Dr. Lori Marker, are there many cheetahs in zoos?
Well, I actually manage the International Cheetah Studbook, and there are around 1,500 cheetahs living in zoos around the world in around 65 countries and 250 facilities. The cheetahs are an animal that do not breed well in captivity, and that's one of the main reasons I set up the Cheetah Conservation Fund out in Namibia, working with my partners in Africa. Interesting where you are there in New Mexico, the first artificial insemination cheetah cub was born at the Albuquerque Zoo. Her name was called Esperanza, which meant hope. And many years and years of research, my research collaboration is with the Smithsonian Institution, we've been able to actually work hard at trying to develop not only breeding techniques that help cheetahs in zoos, but also artificial techniques that will allow us to bank down sperm and ovaries from wild-caught animals or animals that have been found dead or shot and bank those for the future using techniques like artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization.
Which could, in theory, help the genetic diversity problem?
Well, absolutely, and at least by banking them. We have a huge, it's called a genome resource bank, where we get sperm from all the wild male that we've worked on and embryos from females that have been killed by farmers or hunters. And with that, as we develop our techniques, these are saving those genes of animals that would have just been lost. As I mentioned earlier, it's a numbers game. We can't lose much more of the diversity, and each and every cheetah is so very valuable that we need to maintain it, grow it, and store it for the future as well. And then that continues on with the extensive biological research that needs to be done as well. Now, at the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia, we've got veterinary labs, a genetic lab, a reproductive physiology lab, and we are also based basically out in the middle of the bush. We've got a very large, what's called a model farm, where we do raise livestock, sheep, and wildlife, an integrated system where we've got cheetahs and leopards and, you know, hyenas and jackals all living on the land as well. But our research center, where we do, we've got a genetics lab and a veterinary clinic and a reproductive physiology lab. We've actually developed our center, we make our own electricity and we have to pump our own water. So we've been quite an example of a field research project in basically the middle of nowhere and actually conducting first world science. And we believe that good science and conservation go hand in hand. And then from that, we also do a lot of training of local Africans who will be the next generation of the scientists, the biologists, who are going to be the ones taking care of their wildlife. So we welcome people actually to visit us at the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia, learn about what we do. We really encourage people to go to our website, which is cheetah.org. And from that, you can find out about getting the book, which is called A Future for Cheetah, and learning about the different programs that we have at the Cheetah Conservation Fund and how people in America can help support the work that we're doing to save this amazing species for future generations. And we need your help to help the cheetah in Africa to survive in the future.
Dr. Lori Marker is founder and executive director of the Cheetah Conservation Fund, once again at cheetah.org. She is a wildlife scientist, and Susie Esterhaas is a photographer. The two of them have this wonderful book called A Future for Cheetahs, the photographs and the text, but these photographs are so beautiful and amazing and just make you fall in love with these creatures. And Susie Esterhaas is a very distinguished wildlife photographer, and I will link to her page on my website as well. That's SusieEsterhaas.com. I want to thank you both so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.